Welcome to the Earned First podcast. This is Arun Sudhaman, and I'm joined today by someone who I've known for quite a while in the public relations industry here in Asia. Caroline Xu is the Chief Global Officer at the Hoffman Agency and also the Managing Director for the Hoffman Agency in Asia Pacific. Caroline, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Arun. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. You've been with Hoffman for how many years now?
Oh, my goodness. 8 years, if you can believe
Eight
that.
8 years. Okay. Wow. Yes. No, I remember when you joined. I actually can't believe it was 8 years ago. Now, you had joined Hoffman after spending several years on the in-house side of the fence.
Yes.
And we'll talk about the progress you've overseen at Hoffman over the past 8 years, which has been, you know, quite interesting, I think, from an industry perspective. But let's talk about your decision, first of all, to move from in-house back to agency. What was your thinking at that point?
Yeah. So, I mean, a little bit about myself. I think, you know, I am kind of that odd person in that I consider myself a third culture kid. And that means, you know, I grew up in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not. You know, I was educated in the American school system. And then I've spent, you know, over since 2000, I moved back to Asia and started off as a reporter, honestly, and then moved into agency for a really short stint. And as you mentioned, I've been in-house for the last 15 years, you know, since before coming to Hoffman. So I was at the likes of, say, like, worked at HTC, worked at, you know, TomTom, worked at BenQ, Google. After Google, I was there for a very long stint. I moved into Appier as a CMO, and that's a startup that IPO'd in Tokyo Stock Exchange a couple of years back. And then I decided to join Hoffman. And the story really is I met Lou Hoffman over 20, 30 years ago. In fact, the first agency I worked for, we were affiliate partners with Lou. And then, you know, throughout that journey, I became a client. So while I was working at Hoffman, while I was working at Google, especially, you know, Hoffman was our agency. And so it's not only interesting in that I moved from agency to from in-house to agency side. I actually moved from literally Hoffman's client side to agency, but now at a more senior level. And back to your question, the reason I decided to do this move is, look, it got to a point where, you know, when you're young and you're ambitious, I wanted to kind of learn all aspects in our industry, right? From media to PR, client side, to agency side, to, you know, marketing and everything else included. And it got to a point where I was like, you know, after being at a startup, I just felt like I had this passion of wanting to help more brands, especially Asian brands, go global. And that was the reason why I was like, well, where's the platform to do that? And it was just the right timing in life when Lou came to me and was like, do you want to consider joining us? Right. And at that point in time, you know, my dream, I remember in our first chats, I was saying, I really want to help more Asian brands go global. And to me, that's a deal breaker, right? This is something I was really passionate about. I really wanted to become that agency partner where we could help our clients be strategic and not, as an in-house person, having kind of worked with managing five or six different agencies, right? One for PR, another one for events, maybe one for digital. I mean, I could go on and on. And it just, it was like, there's no point. Why can't we have one agency that could be a lead agency or a smart agency and be able to solve all those problems? Because in the end, it's just helping clients to solve problems. And that, you know, that was the start of it. And that was really the reason why I wanted to come this way. And honestly, you know, Lou Hoffman provided me with that platform where it's like, hey, we're independent. you know, let's you know, give you a platform to build this together, and off we go, you know. And mm. that journey has been incredible in that, I'm sure we'll get into it in a little bit, but, you know, we started out as really, you know, more focused on bread and butter PR. And then, mm-hmm. you know, 8 years later, that journey has turned into, it's very integrated. It's very focused on solving problems as opposed to how many press releases, how many events, how many, you know, XYZ are we doing for our clients? I feel like, you know, it's been a fun journey. And that's mm-hmm. why I'm still here, honestly.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask you, did you think it would be more fun than working in-house, working in an agency again?
Well, you know, I get asked this a lot, right? Even with my colleagues here, especially the younger colleagues. And I say it's a different dynamic. So let's be honest, in-house, I've been in-house 15 years, a total of 30 years of experience in tech. But being in-house, I think sometimes it is managing the politics and a budget as opposed to, you know, it really being able to focus more on the real work. And that's why, you know, as an in-house person, oftentimes, as you know, Arun, it's really a handful of people. Oftentimes, maybe it's between one person managing everything, especially in APAC, to maybe at most two or three, you know, depending on the markets and whatnot. And so there's a lot of details and nuances there. But this is why, you know, you need to have a strong partner on the agency side. And so for me, fundamentally, we're talking about a different day job, right? If we have to discuss what does a day look like on an in-house side versus on agency side, we're talking night and day. So you can't compare apples to oranges, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's been interesting watching your leadership of Hoffman over the last 8 years, because it has been a time of such immense change, both for the agency business and the in-house side. But just one last question on the whole in-house versus agency thing, before we talk a bit more about Hoffman. There's still sometimes this feeling, I think, in Asia, particularly amongst younger to mid-level talent, that they need to get in-house as soon as possible. That's the promised land. Yes. Their parents will finally know who they work for. I mean, does this still exist? Do you still think this is a challenge for the industry?
It very much is. I do think the degree has maybe, you know, being, it's like a pendulum, right? It swings back and forth year on year. I do feel like there is that aspiration or that pressure from, like you said, family or colleagues around you. But honestly, you know, I really, really recommend to, you know, my team members and to the audience out there, I think you have to think about what you want and how much impact you want to make. Because increasingly so, it's no longer the day when you go in-house as a SAE or AM from agency side moving in-house, you no longer have much of a say at that level. So unless you're going in-house at a director or more senior level, or let's say a specific company where they really have a platform for you to really make change and really be part of the conversation at the table with your sales heads, with your comms leaders at a regional level or even global level, you know, then is that impactful? Is that what you really want just to get that name under the belt, right? So for me, I really feel like, you know, it's hard when you're in that situation, but it really is about, you know, are you trying to make impact or are you trying to just kind of check off that list and put it on your resume? And I feel like it's a hard call depending on your background, depending on, you know, your family. You know, our parents have a big say in the Asia culture. But that's how I look at it, because, you know, we work with a lot of clients and you know, and as being in-house myself, you know, your personality helps you drive things. The platform or the company that you work for helps you, allows you to do that. But on average, I stick by my guns and said what I just said, which is, you know, if you're going in at a junior level, are you ready to have those tough conversations in the room and be able to be persuasive enough to make change? Right? Or is this still same, same, but different, as we say in Asia, right? You go in and you start talking about press releases. I mean, for goodness sake, is that why you joined in-house?
Yeah. It's not, you often get the impression that it's not necessarily an active decision. It's just a kind of, you know, this is the route that we should take, rather than necessarily thinking about, like you said, where you can have the most impact.
If I may,
if
I may, I just wanted to add, right? If you look at my resume and my journey, I just want to say it was designed intentionally. So I'm a very intentional person, meaning that, you know, when I chose to join, you know, switching from a journalist to working at an agency, I wanted to get the PR experience, not from one company, but really get, you know, the trade under your belt, right? The intentional kind of decision there. And when I wanted, you know, after years of experience, when I wanted to move in-house, I wanted to know where the decisions are getting made at what levels when you're in-house. It was very intentional. And when there was no longer a platform to learn, that's why I jumped. So one thing probably some people may not know about me. Yes, I did, you know, work in-house for over 15 years, but it's many different roles. Like I moved from PR into, you know, marketing, into, you know, a bigger, you know, leadership role overseeing, you know, different departments. And under marketing, we could talk about digital, content development, lead generation. So it was very intentional. And I think going back to your earlier question, you know, are people, are younger people these days making that intentional call about what they want to learn or what they want to achieve when they go in-house or when they do decide to stay longer on the agency side? And I think that's rare these days to have that, take that extra minute to have that thinking, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Or maybe even more than a minute, hopefully. So you join Hoffman, it's eight years ago. In Asia, Hoffman at that time is, I think, around 4 to 5 million in fee income. Is that is that about right?
I think it was more about 8 to 10 million.
Okay. 8 to 10.
So, and then we were at, when I joined, it was about 100 people in 6 markets. And today,
and
you
know,
today we're, you know, on track to being 20 million this year. And we're over 200 people, you know, it could possibly get to 230 by the end of this year, you know, that I'm responsible for. But you also know my role has evolved in the last couple of years from just pure APAC to what I'm calling more of a, you know, global business development, but especially Asia, Middle East, and Africa. So that's what I'm kind of focused on in terms of business development. So it has evolved in that sense.
As it should. I mean, Hoffman now is, I think, 32 million in fee income, according to its latest results for 2024. Obviously, it has bought an agency in the UK as well, in CC Group. So certainly feels like there's good momentum. A lot of that, of course, I think is being driven from Asia. Certainly, you know, if you look at the breakdown of revenue, it's very rare to see an agency, an American agency that, you know, derives more of its fee income from Asia. But also you've done it during an interesting period. I would probably say the first half of your tenure, everyone was growing.
Yes.
The first 4 to 5 years, obviously, then the pandemic comes. That's challenging in many ways, but actually for B2B tech, it was not necessarily, you know, as difficult as it was in other sectors. Indeed, there was a fair amount of growth, as I recall,
yes,
from B2B tech. Hoffman, you guys won Zoom, for example, which was a success story, let's say, during the pandemic. Then we exit the COVID era, thankfully, but there's a huge slowdown in the tech sector. And this is what has really, I think, slowed down a lot of the Asia Pacific market, because the industry here is heavily driven, I think, by technology. But you've continued more or less to grow, if I'm not mistaken. So how have you managed that? What's the secret?
You know, honestly, I think we're very lucky. You know, again, there's few independent agencies out there, and I wear that with pride. So does Lou. And part of the reason, I think, is that independence, right, allows us to have more agility and flexibility. And doing so, I think, you know, out there, a lot of people talk about one P&L. I mean, you know this, but are they truly one P&L, right? Because here we are able to one P&L, one invoice, right? And we can, nobody's fighting over budget. We do what's right for the client. And I think, you know, that has been miraculous, because there's been many scenarios, and we're able to pivot differently every year for a different reason. But if I go back to the very beginning, right, I think it was definitely, you know, PR and then embracing integrated, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what was important was really doubling down on tech and B2B. And I know where, you know, along the years, some agency have kind of veered toward one way or another, or consolidation or whatnot. I would say, you know, one of my beliefs, and this was one of the reasons why I joined Hoffman and joined Lou, is really my passion in tech, and knowing that tech and B2B, no matter the ups and downs, it was the right space to be in. Because if you look around nowadays, which company doesn't have tech? Right. Even if it's a consumer company. So, you know, that's one thing. And we really, you know, while people were kind of moving to different areas, we really doubled down on tech. Right. We did not go off this weird path. And as part of this, I think, you know, we've won multiple years globally and in Asia as a tech agency of the year. And it's due to that diligence. Right. So number one there. Number two, due to what I shared earlier, and which it really is about, we wanted to be that agency partner, that partner being very important, right? We don't need to get into your room and talk about the scope of work and, you know, details. That's the details. That's semantics. What we really want to talk about is, you know, hey, client, hey, partner, what are you dealing with right now? What's on your mind as a comms lead or as a marketing lead? What's your mind in terms of your product guys, your sales folks? What's the problem you're trying to solve? And I think that was almost like another pivot in our growth, which was really looking at it from that perspective. So, you know, nowadays we're working with our clients talking about, you know, for example, pre-COVID, it was about talent acquisition. And, you know, some of our clients like ASML or even TSMC or whatnot, you know, we're helping them with employer branding, right? And so it's starting with a problem and then working in reverse and looking at, if you look at everything as a tool from earned, owned, paid, all that are just toolkits in helping you solve that problems. And in some cases, it's about, you know, partnerships. How do you bring the right people on the client side to the table with you to solve that problem together? Because it's never just one department. You know, oftentimes, I think compared to other agencies, we're working with multiple departments at the same time, from comms teams to marketing as basics to even HR teams to business teams, product teams, and at various levels, right? Local country level, regional level, even global level. And so that's another pivot there. And if I may go back to the one P&L thing, right? What's also helpful, right, is our unique multi-hub model. Because of our one P&L, we have different types and ways of running hubs. So for some clients, when things are centralized in the US or Europe, we can, you know, look at what a centralized model may look like, which is more typical for other agencies, right? They're usually either in UK, US, Silicon Valley, or out here in Asia, you and I know it's mostly Hong Kong or Singapore running hub, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one model. But for us, we have many types of model because we're flexible as an independent. We're agile in that way. And it becomes, you know, we can have a regionalized model where maybe there is a hub in every region, a hub team here in APAC, a hub team in US or Europe working together to service the same client globally. You know, in other ways, we have a blended model. And what that means is depending on the needs of the client, if their main market is, say, China or Japan, it is important for the local nuances. And Arun, you kind of know my background here, but, you know, I'm such a stickler of APAC is not just one region. And, you know, you have to have the right people at the seat to have the right conversations to move the needle for them in terms of solving problems and, you know, helping with sales or whatnot. And you know, and that's how we run it. And these kind of models, they don't have to be set in a certain way. It's almost customized. So there's that thing there. And I think, you know, it's really just in the end, it's agility and flexibility and the willingness to listen. And I use this word a lot. We've got to pivot, right? Here at Hoffman, yes, we have yearly plans. Yes, we have, you know, quarterly, you know, half year quarterly plans. But by the time we're done with planning, in our world, it moves so fast, it's almost like your plan is out of date. And I think, you know, it's not just in the planning of the, on the agency side, but we do the same. We have to move just as fast, if not faster, when planning for our clients. And how we're set up affords that agility. Also, if I may, you know, I want to say I'm quite proud of the team we brought together, you know, globally, but really across APAC, because we believe in diversity, and that's another bucket in itself. But when I say diversity, I'm actually talking about diversity of backgrounds, right? Yeah. I'm really proud of the fact that we're 99.XYZ, you know, local. And that means, you know, when we're servicing you from a specific market, you know, globally or regionally, it's people on the ground, people who know exactly what happened today because of the tariffs. Who knows exactly what happened because of something happening locally in terms of a political, you know, tech diplomacy, as I like to call it, geopolitics. So I think that makes a difference in terms of how fast we can pivot and how agile we can be. And we're able to move that needle a bit faster. And, you know, we've been lucky in that way. And by bringing in even more people that are experienced from different different backgrounds, including myself, I've hired a lot of people that came from in-house. Public affairs background, that came from marketing backgrounds, digital backgrounds, even engineering tech. That's quite rare. And in doing so, we kind of bring a different angle to the table, to the problem, so to speak. And then that whole conversation then doesn't become, hey, let's talk about, you know, how many press releases and how many events. I mean, that's part of a means to an end, right? We all have to talk contracts. We all have to do that. But when you start at, hey, how can we help you? How can we solve your problem? I think it's a whole nother kind of conversation. And this is not possible if it was just me, right? Me, myself, and I, or even me and Lou. That's not possible. We need more of people with different background that can navigate the complexities that we're dealing with. I mean, every day, you know, there's a word that we use internally right now, and it's called polycrises. And it used to be one thing after another. You mentioned COVID. Then you get hit by XYZ. But now it's no. You're dealing with five issues in the same day. Either some layoff somewhere, some government changing something, US and European laws making an impact in our business, you know, stock market, you know, whatnot. But we're dealing with those things all at the same time. So even as a leader trying to run a business or thinking about putting ourselves in our clients' shoes to navigate that, it's complex. It's not an easy job, and you need people that are that come from a diversity of backgrounds. And so, you know, sorry, you can tell I'm on my soapbox when it comes to this.
Well, I did ask, so it's fine. No, it's actually quite interesting because it's quite a comprehensive answer. But what the theme, the recurring theme, I think, is that you've had a lot of freedom to build the business the way you see fit, which often isn't the case with U.S. headquartered consultancies. You mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to pick up on. The first, the single P&L, right? Which, yes, I would say Hoffman is not the only agency to talk about that, of course. But the other thing, I guess, when we're talking about single P&Ls is one of the reasons why, you know, big networks don't use single P&Ls is because they need to be able to track performance of different markets. They incentivize leaders based on specific silos and so on. So how do you respond to that kind of a challenge, perhaps? You know, the potential drawbacks of the single P&L model.
Yeah, I love it. Totally understand, totally hear you. I think it's something we wear with pride here, and it's something I'm always thinking about daily. And it really is, you know, we're only successful as one team. Mm. And, you know, myself, I lead by example, but also, you know, my leadership team all the way down to the ADs, the SAEs, to interns, you know, they all kind of are ingrained in this way. But, you know, it's easier said than done, right? So I think, you know, sometimes I have to be judge, jury, sheriff, whatever you want to call it, right? And Lou needs to do the same, and certain leaders across the board. But and it's all about a give and a take also, if we talk about business, where, hey, this time we need a certain market to play ball. Next time it's another market, but we give and we take. I think as part of this, let me be a little bit more real. If we're talking about younger people, I think it helps that we have chemistry. Mm. And we're proud to say we have chemistry. When we get into a room and we're having conversation with clients, no matter what level, everyone knows each other. And how is that doable? It helps with that one team mentality, one P&L mentality. And we do so with several different programs that we have in place, one of which we're quite proud of. I'll name a few because it does help. One is building bridges. And so we build bridges as in, you know, for, you know, our younger folks, and even senior folks, it really depends. You know, you're able to apply for a program, whether it's within Asia or cross borders, you know, in US, Europe, or in any of our offices, where you go and work for a period of time, you know, in that other market. And doing so, you break down barriers between people, between cultures, and, you know, and we're avid about this. We do this every single year.
So you don't think necessarily getting bigger size is, you know, is naturally going to reduce the amount of familiarity people have with each other?
Not if you're diligent. And how we do that, I think it's almost, what's a better word for it? It really is a culture thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's day in and day out. It's not just saying it. We're proud of it. We wear it on our sleeves every single day. And it's making it happen. So, you know, another program I find very useful, we call it Hot Anywhere. And what that means is when our team members are traveling on their own vacation time, say they're going to, you know, Japan for vacation, we have a program where we subsidize our employees and team members to stay behind. And after your vacation, go into that office in that country you're visiting in, go in, do a sharing, we'll cover your costs while you're out there for a certain duration. And these things, I know it sounds like, it seems like, really, Caroline, really? Yes, really, it adds up. All these things. Or even we do, I'm sorry, Akiba, it's called Ha Amplify, yes, Hoffman, so Ha. You know, but it's mentorship programs where we team up people cross borders. So every little thing adds up, every single little thing. Just speaking to you, you know, before speaking to you today, Lou and I was on a, you know, a all hands with EMEA, this region, and sharing insights globally and within the region, even things like that, which I'm sure everyone does. But the level of detail and the oomph you put into it, I really feel like it adds up. And, you know, we wear it with pride, and it's across our all leadership and across all levels. And, you know, and in that case, if I may, long-winded answer, but my last point really is it comes down to it boils down to chemistry and not having to fake it. Because when push comes to shove and you get into a room, you're pitching or talking to a client, chemistry shows. Meaning like, I already know you, Arun. You already know me. The vibe is there, how we're able to riff off each other or with our clients, or the fact that, you know, we really can read each other's minds. It makes a difference. And if I may, indulge me, my last point, I promise. I also really believe hard in the bait and switch issue where, you know, in eight specific agencies, they may have a strong pitch team that goes in. We're the pitchers. We're very good. We're very salesy or very flashy, very creative. And you go win the business. But here, you know, I think it's called realistic creativity for us. And it's about us, you know, when we decide on the team that we pull together for our clients, we go in as one team, and that's the team that's going to be servicing the client. There's no bait and switch. It includes senior people like myself, GMs and whatnot. It's like, I always kind of joke, but not really. I actually mean it. I tell our clients, I really hope you like us, because we're kind of, this is it. Like, this is a team that's going to service you in X markets, or, you know, globally or regionally. And, you know, clients like that, right? And I think part of it that goes back to also my background and my team members' background, where we used to be a client. We don't like it when, you know, your teams always get switched on the agency side. But, you know, we don't have that issue, you know?
So you also mentioned, you know, that this model where you don't necessarily build around specific hubs, or at least not around traditional hubs, which is kind of how the market has developed. Although I think increasingly in Asia, we're seeing we're seeing multiple hubs now emerging. But it speaks to the broader issue, I think, in Asia, where particularly with multinationals, they still don't always, or they're still not always up to date in terms of how things progress within local markets. And we've kind of talked about this before. We did a PRCA session earlier this year about how global brands can become more local. Are you still seeing that as a significant challenge in Asia in terms of how global brands are going to market? And I wonder if there's anything that global brands can perhaps learn from Asian tech brands in that regard.
I really feel like, you know, it depends on which stage you are as a client, if that makes sense. You know, all of us work with clients where there's no comms people on the ground, or, you know, there's comms people maybe at the APAC level or at the global level, right? So, and it's at the very different stages of maturity in terms of how they're running their business and whatnot. So I do feel like this is why maybe it is easier for Hoffman, for us, to be different in that way. Because unlike the traditional hubs, I do feel like depending on the clients, we aspire that every single market can be a hub, if that makes sense. And that works very well for clients we work with, especially Chinese clients, where their preference is to speak to us in Chinese, yet they want to do work across Asia and globally. You see where I'm coming with that, right? People maybe will prefer to speak in their local language with local cultural nuances, or being able to attend meetings with them where they have to switch between Chinese and English. And, you know, case in point, put in another country, Korean MNCs, case in point, you know, Japanese or whatnot. So you get that point. So I feel like that would be how I look at it, where you there is various levels of issues, but it really depends on which stage the client is and whether we're talking about startups all the way to, you know, Fortune 500 companies, and then how they're set up. And oftentimes, you know, it was only in the last couple of years, really, well, the last 8 years, and that's why you see great growth, where, you know, Western companies are doubling down in Asia in terms of putting resources. But even so, it's still very scarce. I mean, I'm not going to put my clients' names out there because I don't, you know, I don't want to put them on the spot. But many of our clients, you know, for such a big name, it's like one or two people managing how many markets in APAC. I think that's what you're alluding to, right, Arun? So we have to do our job. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just resourcing, though, is it? Sometimes it's also a mindset. Which may be a result of resourcing, but it sometimes seems like there's an educational process involved in perhaps with clients, and not necessarily just Western clients, right? You may also be finding that now with Chinese clients who are, you know, looking at Southeast Asia, right?
Yes.
Who are looking at Southeast Asia for growth, or beyond Asia, they're looking, and they need to understand what's happening, what happens at head office isn't what's going to be happening at a local market. Do you think that's still a challenge?
I think it is. I mean, the honest truth, it is. And so in the end, how I look at it is, you know, I always tell a team, control what we can control, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think people like yourself, myself, and our peers in the industry, I think we work really hard to educate the industry as a whole and indirectly, you know, decision makers on the client side on the global level. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I think we just have to find a way to work around it while the education is catching up, if that makes sense, right?
Sure.
And I think given our financial power, the rise of Asian brands, or, you know, Asia, Middle East, and Africa, right? Given that, I think the willingness of, I don't want to use Westerners, but the willingness of non-local people, right? Mm-hmm. To listen and really understand the cultural nuances has made a difference in that they're more open-minded now and really want to get, we really want you to tell us, how do we actually get started in this market? Mm-hmm. Like, we really want to learn from you and the team. There might be difficulties to get there, but at least I do see, you know, compared to when we're starting out in our careers, or even compared to 8 years ago, I do feel like there has been progression for the better, but it's not there. I mean, let's be honest, you know, we're still trying to educate, you know, and vice versa. So I think that still needs a continuation from all of us.
The saga continues. So final question, or final segment, tell me about the Chip Odyssey, because obviously for those of you who aren't aware, this is a documentary about the rise and growth and success of Taiwan's chip sector. I haven't seen it because I think it's actually on release in cinemas, and it hasn't come to a cinema near me yet. But for you as a proud Taiwanese, and of course someone who's so, like, you know, you're immersed in the chip sector for many years. How did you feel about the documentary? And secondly, what does it tell us about both the industry and about Taiwan as a nation brand?
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, honestly, you're right. People I speak to within our industry, as in tech industry, or even across Taiwan, you know, everyone's just, it's a proud moment, because it really was, to me, maybe at my age, I'm sounding old, but I just feel like it's almost a reflection of my own personal career. Mm. And I can say that for people, you know, many of us, we feel like it has been a journey. And, you know, it's a reflection of our own careers, because if you're in PR and in tech, you've at least interacted with semiconductors. And I know, you know, semiconductors maybe became a popular term or, you know, just a couple of years ago with the rise of the ecosystem and the meaning of why, you know, semiconductors are important. But for us in Taiwan, we live and breathe this, right? Mm-hmm. And so at, you know, looking at the documentary, it was a reflection of self-reflection. It was a reflection at a national level. And, you know, nobody walked out of the movie theater without crying. So, you know, everyone I know around me, you know, we all shed a tear or two. And to us, it was really a national leap of faith, you know,
yeah.
In a time where, you know, Taiwan government had to make a bold long-term bet in a sector, and they chose semiconductors. I mean, this makes sense now when you're reflecting and looking at retrospect, but it wasn't then. It wasn't like, it was a bold decision. It wasn't like, oh yeah, of course this is the way to go, which seems like now, but it wasn't then, right? And then it took a certain group of people with that leap of faith, sweat and tears, you know, going to the US, government putting in money, you know, bringing people back, you know, having, you know, studied in the US and whatnot. And that was kind of where TSMC, Morris Chang, you know, UMC, and all of that came about. And as part of that, you know, I think it really, a reflection, I think, is also, you know, it made us proud that, you know, we made a commitment and we stuck to it for how many years. And the commitment was such a big bet, right? If this didn't work, then what will we have today in Taiwan, right? And so, you know, I think that was really powerful for us. At the same time, I think that commitment level is a commitment to excellence. It's a commitment in terms of time, in terms of 24/7, to quality, to precision, to really just that standard that we set there. And it was then a commitment also then to build out what I call the semiconductor ecosystem. And that's hard to replicate, because for those of you out there, I don't know if you know Taiwan very well, but, you know, within 200 kilometer radius, we have several science parks. You know, it's, we don't have to worry about inventory, because, you know, after your parts are being manufactured, you know, it goes from one company to another, and then it gets shipped out. Like, this is not something that is easy to replicate. So, you know, coming back to that, maybe I take a pause, but, you know, it's really a proud moment, a leap of faith. And I remember there was one line in the documentary where, you know, a tearjerker, where they, you know, it was, failure is not an option. And I don't know, maybe it's the age thing again, Arun, but I mean, that line, failure is not an option. Like, how much commitment goes into that one little line?
Yeah.
There's no choice. We made a big bet. We now need to execute. And fast forward, this is where we're today. And, you know, we're powering the world's IT and the world's industry. And, you know, all these companies that you're familiar with, NVIDIA, $4 trillion company, all these companies, you know, they're all close partners to the Taiwan tech ecosystem. Yeah. And that way, you know, that's why you're hearing terms like the Silicon Shield, you know, helping us, you know, I want to kind of have a place at the global stage. You know, let's not get into politics. We have a lot of listeners here from all over the world.
I was hoping we would, actually, but okay.
I mean, if you like.
At the very least, I mean, look, if we're going to talk about chips, we can't ignore the, can we say elephant in the room? We can't ignore the political issues. You know, chips have become a very political issue over the last couple of years, especially since, you know, again, since January of this year. Do you think that a documentary like this can help in terms of, you know, in the way it helps to position Taiwan's chip industry? You know, obviously with a documentary, maybe not, you wonder about how many people are going to see it. But just in terms of the narrative that perhaps it gives, it kind of helps the industry and all of its stakeholders and all, the whole ecosystem, gives them a kind of platform to unite around. Yeah. Is it helpful from that perspective, do you think? Particularly given some of these political challenges.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a rallying cry, right? Because honestly, as Taiwanese people or as a semiconductor industry, we've been rallying for years. And so, you know, there's a lot of Taiwanese government commitment. I think, you know, each company in the ecosystem has a role, and especially, you know, in Taiwan, everyone knows their role and the importance of this. And so, you know, one documentary is not going to make that change, because I think we've been on this journey, right? Given the last couple of years. And also, I mean, let's not forget all the other books that have been written, right? Like Chip War and whatnot. So I think at this moment, though, it is a really important rallying cry from a national perspective as a Taiwanese, you know, for everyone to, you know, come together, be proud, stick together, and, you know, do what we need to do. So there is that. But on a global level, I think there's too many things at play. And I think, you know, we'll go on and on. But given the U.S. government and the difference between Biden and Trump administration and their take on semiconductors and, you know, what's needed, the amount of investment they're trying to move back to U.S., I think that's an interesting one to follow. I think, you know, Taiwan government and Taiwan's semiconductor ecosystem has a place in all of this. But, you know, all of that's going to take a while, right? So we do what we do best, which is hunker down and deliver, you know, and try not to be like get caught in the day to day of the change. You know, wake up, tariffs change, or, you know, perspectives change in terms of investments in what, in where and what, you know, the recent news around Intel, you know, and where is Intel going to go there, the next move there, or, you know, are we really going to double down in Arizona, Phoenix, in terms of bringing kind of the whole ecosystem to the U.S., you know, life still continues as we see it, you know, out here in Asia or out here in the semiconductor industry, because you can do that, invest in that while still investing here. And we see also investment moving to Southeast Asia, right? If we're talking from a tech or chip industry perspective. So I think there's still a lot in the air. But, you know, something of this magnitude is not easy to duplicate overnight.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like, hey, let's slap a Band-Aid on this and yay, make it into a political statement. It's really going to change overnight, because day in and day out, with the rise of AI, you need semiconductors. It is literally the engine, you know, of all things tech. So I feel like, you know, on one end, it's all the changes and shifts on a geopolitical or on a national front on many countries' agenda. But at the same time, we're not going to stop, right? There is a need every single day to keep production and keep things rolling, and most importantly, keep innovation moving.
Yeah.
And this is why, I mean, you're seeing all of the CEOs, if you're watching, right, all of the CEOs of big tech companies, you know, in the last couple Computexes, which is our one of the largest IT kind of trade shows here in Taiwan, they're all flying to tell, you know, Intel, Qualcomm, ARM, NVIDIA. You know, they're all here. Why? I mean, it's not replaceable overnight, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make. And that the show has to go on, and we're not going to stop because of geopolitics or because of, you know, those are just what I call a little bit of obstacles in the way, or, you know, you have to, you know, navigate. But I'm always quite proud as a Taiwanese to say that, you know, similar to the Hoffman way, we're scrappy and we're flexible, and we just learn how to navigate that scene. And so let's eyes on the prize, You know, I think we know what needs to get done. And I think as Asians, as Taiwanese people, as semiconductor industry, we're not stopping it. You know, we're chipping away at it. So we'll let politics do its thing. But, you know, we're smart people. And we'll find a way to make it work for everyone, because we can't stop. Not with, you know, leaps and leaps in advancement in tech, in AI, in quantum computing and all that happening all at the same time. Yeah. Sorry,
it's good advice. No, I understand. It's good advice, like you said. I can see that you've got that kind of perspective from multiple markets and multiple sectors. It's a classic third culture perspective. Yes. It's great to see. So, Caroline, thank you so much for your time on the podcast today. Hopefully, I will see you soon, and we will no doubt welcome you back onto the podcast at some point in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arun, and thank you everyone for your time today.